Hello, this is Kat.
And this is Phoebe. We're Feminine Chaos.
We sure are.
Podcast.
Phoebe, what are we talking about today?
We are being very glamorous because we recently did a guest, I was going to say a guest blog. That's not the one. Guest podcast.
Guest cast. Guest pod.
A guest. We guest podded at our friendly neighbors Blocked and Reported, right?
Yes.
We should plug that.
One of us will remember to put that link in the show notes. So if you've come over here from Blocked and Reported, welcome. Also, if you've come over here from the Fifth Column, also welcome. I was on all the podcasts last week. I was much in demand.
Somebody commented about this to me saying that I should be mad at you that you didn't mention this podcast on some other podcast. And it's a podcast that I do not listen to. So I didn't know I was supposed to be mad. I'm mad. I'm not going to take it. No. Which podcast were you on?
I was on the Fifth Column with Camille Foster, Michael Moynihan, and Matt Welch, who are pals of mine, but also they invited me to join them on their podcast. I realized, I don't know if this is like me being an amateur thing or if it's the fact that I was just hanging out with a bunch of men thing, but it's like they didn't eat or they weren't planning to eat. I guess they just like they when they record their podcast, they just get drunk and like spend the evening talking and drinking and never actually eat food, which is not a tenable situation for me.
It seems almost like an undergrad girl thing. It doesn't seem very...
Right? Huh. I mean... Yeah. So I was in this interesting position where like I arrived to record and I was handed a Negroni about the size of my head right off the bat. And I was like, yeah, this is fine. This is great. I'm living the life of a podcaster. And then eventually we all sat down to record and I was like, do you guys not eat dinner? Like, you invited me to come podcast with you starting at 7:30 and you're not gonna feed me. So a pizza was ordered, but that did not
for you personally.
Well, you know, technically I think Camille ordered it for himself, but then I was given a slice of it. I was actually given a very primo slice because he ordered a Sicilian pie and then they gave me a corner, and you know, those are in high demand. There's only four of them.
That's good real estate.
Yeah.
So is this just your long way of saying that you were too drunk to remember to plug the Feminine Chaos podcast on another podcast?
Yes, and I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I often get drunk and forget myself.
It can happen. It can happen. So one thing that can happen when people get drunk, segue. Can I do a segue?
Oh, yeah, please, by all means.
They get sexually adventurous.
How did you know? You know, as it would happen on this podcast.
I assume you say you were with a bunch of men and in person, right? Because Blocked and Reported, we did not do in person.
We recorded it remotely. And that's just because it was three mm-hmm. women, right?
So, right. Well, although, I mean, and women have never been known to get in sexual situations with each other. And if you want to hear more about how that's physically impossible, I direct you to one Katie Herzog of Boston Reported.
Yes. But no, to be clear, I did not sleep with all three of the podcasters on the Fifth Column. I only slept with one of them, and you'll have to guess who.
I wondering where you would finish with that.
This is also a joke. Okay, I'm going to get in trouble. But yeah, sexually adventurous, that's a thing. That's a thing that happens when you get drunk. But to whom are we referring when we talk about people being sexually adventurous?
So this is something that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of the whole straight women project, just this idea that sexually adventurous in a woman, that sort of a claim of bi-curiousness is kind of a proxy for this bigger category of sexual adventurousness. And I just keep thinking about how that whole category just doesn't really exist for men. And I tweeted this and I heard, as one does, that I was wrong. And I guess it does exist for gay men, but it means something completely different. And it's like this public health category that means that you're sleeping with a lot of men and doing so in risky ways with certain drugs or certain lack of protective measures.
I believe this is what's known as the monkeypox transmission vector.
But roughly that, yes.
I want to yes and this. I'm going to yes and the disagreement with you because true that there is, yes, this category of sexually adventurous men that refers very specifically to men who are doing kind of high risk gay things in their lives. But also, I think that when someone says to me sexually adventurous man, I immediately think of like a hypothetical guy who is into weird kink, you know, like getting pegged on a trapeze by a person dressed as like a clown.
Okay, so I have a response to this, but I will not give it until you have finished the image. So anything else happening? There's the trapeze, the clown. And what else?
The pegging.
Or was that the whole story?
I could stop it there. I mean, in my mind, there is more, but I don't want, you know, this is a free episode of the podcast, so.
For that, you have to pay a little extra. Yeah, so I've thought about that. And people have said to me, like, well, what about kinky men? What about men into weird stuff, whatever? And I don't think that's the same thing. So basically, I think sexually adventurous is different from having wild interests or indeed wild interests that you're pursuing. To me, sexually adventurous means that you are amenable to trying different things that may not be and aren't necessarily things you have any particular sexual interest in doing. It's not that you have some like deep-seated, like ever since you can remember, interest in some trapeze and whatever this is. It's that there is the trapeze, somebody else has suggested it, and you're game for anything. So that's why I would categorize, I wouldn't say that a woman who just is bisexual and is with men and women is sexually adventurous or anything like that. I think it's neither here nor there. But I would say that a straight woman who feels like a man suggests a threesome with another woman and she needs to go ahead with it to be sexually adventurous, that is where sexually adventurous comes into play.
Okay, I think you may have almost convinced me. Except that I think there's one thing that maybe is missing from this kind of conception of sexual adventurousness. And that is the thing that is present in like our kind of our idea of somebody being adventurous just kind of writ large, which is that it's like a risk-taking thing, right? It's, you know, you're adventurous, and like adventurousness has something to do with being willing for the sake of a thrill or for the sake of like novelty to do something that is in some way risky. And I don't think that we really conceive of sex as risky for men, either physically or emotionally, in the way that we do for women. It just is a weird fit to even try to like imagine that as a thing for guys.
Completely. I think that's right. And I think that fits into, but I think that we're in agreement there, because I think it's also that men are just assumed to be interested in taking risks baseline and are just adventurous by nature. Obviously, the reality of men is that most are not, you know, climbing Mount Everest at the moment.
Thank God, because, you know, there's only room for so many people up there.
Yeah, exactly. Although, but think of all they could get up to. But yeah, basically, I think it is this idea that adventurousness is something, it's both that it's not seen as risky for men to have sex at all, but also just, I think there's this idea that they are baseline adventurous and that what's holding them back is women's lack of willingness or availability or whatever. Straight men, obviously, because gay men are not held back by that. But yeah, I just think it is also interesting in conjunction with like there are things men won't do and that women will. And like in the aggregate, and this came up in some of the replies I got on Twitter about this, about like men who won't, everything from like men who will not reciprocate certain acts with women, but also, you know, just again, this whole thing with the bi-curious thing, like obviously there's not any sort of expectation, even I think among the Gen Z or whatever, that men would make out with each other at a bar to impress women, right? Even if these women are all reading whatever it is they all read now. But yeah, I don't know. You know what I mean? Basically, what I'm saying is I would be curious to hear from listeners what the term sexually adventurousness or sexually adventurous means. What does it mean to you? And does this strike you as a gender neutral category? And if not, why not? Or if yes, why? Email us at sexuallyadventurous.blog, whatever.
Oh. Femchaospod.com. Now send us, we have a feminine chaos email. It's like femchaospod or feminine chaos. Let me just see what it is.
Who gets that? Do you get it or do I?
I do. But
okay.
I think I've ever mentioned it before. Femchaospod@gmail.com. FemchaosPod@gmail.com. Yeah.
I will be emailing that regularly every time I want to reach you.
But, you know, when it comes to the question of adventurousness or adventures, I just want to end this part of the discussion by letting J.R.R. Tolkien have the last word, because in one of my favorite stories from childhood, The Hobbit, Bilbo Baggins, who is not adventurous sexually or otherwise, describes adventures as nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things that make you late for dinner. So, yes, I think so.
Okay. Well, that would, I don't know how Molly Roden Winter ever gets to dinner because she's kept so busy.
I think she does. She doesn't. She just gets drunk and sleeps with podcasters.
I was about to say.
And we've come full circle. Okay.
We certainly have.
What else we got on the docket today?
We have, by popular request. Okay. Popular request has not been about sex. Nobody cares what we think about anything sexy. Rather, we are now hoisted into the old lady department, and we're going to be talking about heirloom discourse.
Hoisted by our own old lady petards.
Exactly. Do you know that they used to have all those ads for old lady petards on Twitter, and then they stopped? No, we're just kidding.
A 70-year-old grandma.
Exactly. Hoisted up her own petards.
If you know what we're talking about, I'm sorry, because it means that you are also as terminally online as we are. But yeah, the old lady petard has hoisted us to where?
Yeah. Well, this I think is like a Twitter and Reddit hybrid here, where somebody, this looks like this was from Reddit, I think, put something called "Telling Boomers We Are Going to Throw the China in the Garbage," and it's tagged "Boomer Story." I think it's from Reddit. I don't. It's from something else. Anyway, it says, so it's my wife has had, I'm quoting, okay, I don't have a wife, sorry. My wife.
You're not sexually adventurous enough.
No, I'm not sexually adventurous to have this problem or a wife. My wife has had it with my mother-in-law, thinking that we are going to preserve all her possessions like a museum. Four adult kids who were all home at Easter. Mother-in-law said each of them should pick one of the four different sets of china they want to inherit. Everyone said no. Mother-in-law got all flustered because no one wanted her memories, whatever.
Her memories, like, in the soup tureen? Okay, well,
okay,
anyway.
Okay, well, I'll just read the whole thing. It's not that long. My wife pointed out that they haven't been out of the cabinet in at least 30 years, and we are all here celebrating and using the everyday plates. Mother-in-law tried to lie and say she uses them at Christmas. Wife lost it and reminded her that we have been at every family gathering for decades, and those plates have never been used, and she is going to use them as frisbees once she dies. Another great memory tied to the family china. Okay, so that's the initial thing. Then there is a quote tweet by Jodi Ann Quarry, who I don't know personally, but who seems to be active on Twitter, saying, "This is going to be a sad story for so many families. People are saving mahogany dining sets, break fronts full of exquisite glasses and plates, and whole sets of silverware for their children who do not want, need, or have a place to put them." And that is heirloom discourse, kind of.
Yeah.
So I saw this via Helene Olin, right?
She had a good take on this. I feel like there are several good takes and many bad on this. But I really liked hers, which was just goddamn lie. Just lie and tell, you know, your mom, oh yeah, I want this china set. And like, then when she dies and you inherit it, you can do whatever you want with it. Give it to Goodwill. Use them as frisbees, whatever. But it costs so little to just say, oh yeah, like, I'll take that one.
I guess I'm very preoccupied just on a sort of material level with like very practical aspects of this. Like, if you have to transport it, if it's like, I could see if somebody's like, here is the mahogany dining set, please take it, it's yours, and you live really far from there and you have no space to put it. And you would have to pay to, if you're effectively being asked to pay to remove furniture, unwanted furniture from your parents' house and being told that that's a gift, I could see that being unpleasant, and I would rather just be told, like, I need help getting unwanted furniture out of my house than here is this generous gift of a giant furniture set that, and you live in like a studio apartment that already has furniture. You know, I could see that. But I was also just thinking about this idea of the save. I'm obsessed with this thing of the saving mahogany dining sets. Like, if this is just your table, are you saving it for future generations, or is it your table? You know what I mean? Like, is it a sacrifice? That's the aspect I'm kind of stuck on.
Yeah, that is so interesting. I mean, I suppose that, like, I don't know, is the idea that maybe at some point, like, the parents wanted to get a new table, but they didn't because they were saving this one for their children to inherit. It honestly, it does not make a whole lot of sense. And I think that maybe the whole, like, saving construct actually is not the proper way to articulate it, and makes it a little confusing, where it's not really that they're saving it. It's that they have it and there's the expectation that it will be wanted someday when they're gone, which is a conundrum. I mean, I was thinking about this from the perspective of, like, because people now are getting married later, like, they usually have a household set up. They may even have a household set up independently, and their future spouse does too. And then they're combining two households. So there's already the question of, what do you do with, like, your combined furniture, especially if you don't have similar taste? And then you add in the fact that, like, oh, your parents want to give you things. I feel like it was easier when, you know, you would get married, like, younger, and you would receive heirlooms at that time that had been kind of designated for you for when you left your parents' home and started your own household, that you would need stuff to get started with. But, like, the trajectory of leaving the house and, like, having furniture has gotten all kind of scrambled by contemporary lifestyles. And now there's just all these tables and chairs and china sets and stuff floating around in the ether with nobody to claim them.
Also, just thinking about the whole sort of disposability question, where people are saying, like, it's terrible that people get IKEA because it's, like, fast fashion, it's all disposable. But this is just, it is also just a way of life thing, right? Like, if you live somewhere for not very long, far from your family, even if there are these mahogany whatevers that could be coming your way, they're not, you know? Like, it seems an odd thing to be, like what I've noticed is just this kind of, like, people want IKEA discourse. And I don't think it's that people, like, want it. I think that's just unavoidable, that that's what you get in certain contexts. And however, I'm going to now argue against what I just said. Can I do that? Can I take both sides of the argument?
Do it. Very adventurous of you. I'll stop.
I'm going to go both ways here. So there's this regular on Blogtio where they show these very cool mid-century looking houses and their interiors, and they mock it and they say, oh, you would have to gut this. You would have to do this and this. And it's like, it looks nice, you know, and whatever. And I do think there is this kind of pressure to have things look modern in some way that gets very, very quickly out of date. And I remember, like, this came up.
It was about kitchens. It was about kitchens specifically, that they're dated by the time they're finished because trends move so fast.
Exactly.
I was so fascinated by this because, oh my God, okay, there's, like, all these different threads I want to pull on. Because one, people are, like, moving into their quote unquote forever home much later in life. Like, it's the normal thing through your 20s, maybe even your 30s, that you live in a few different apartments while you're, like, you know, waiting to get established in a home that you're going to stay in. And as I discovered when my husband and I moved from the apartment we had lived in for 10 years, which was in one kind of building, into the home we bought, which is a different kind of building, like, it's really kind of a crapshoot whether your furniture from the old place is going to fit in the new place. Like, different room layouts, different everything. You know this feeling.
I know it so painfully well because, okay, so yes, we moved from a one bedroom that had a very spacious living, just like a living dining room, whatever. That was a very, very big space compared to the rest of the apartment. It was a small apartment, but that was, like, a large part of it, as is often the case in a one-bedroom apartment, right? And now we have this, like, microscopic living room that has in it this enormous couch that just basically is the room, and then an enormous armchair that is the other part of the room, and you, like, can't walk through it.
Yeah, Yeah, it's, oh my God, it's so crazy how this happens. Like with couches especially, I'm sorry, this is like, this is going to be so boring for everyone to listen to, but so maybe I'll cut it out. But like,
no, please don't. I think this is our stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is our area of common interest. So, I mean, in my previous apartment, it was a kind of a railroad apartment. It was about 750 square feet, but we did have this big spacious living room that I managed to kind of almost like carve up into three separate areas. And there was like the little workspace area. And then there was like another sitting area where I had a dining table I could pull out sometimes. And then there was where we would lounge on these two couches that faced opposite each other, and we would watch TV or read or whatever. And that was like the front half of the room. And then the working and like separate sitting area was in the further half of the room, which is to say, like, we had two couches. And when we moved into our house, which is bigger, but not as flexible in terms of the layout, like, we had two couches and neither one of them fit in the only space there is for a couch to go. And I spent like all day pushing furniture around, being like, how can this be? Like, how can I have two couches and neither one of them is going to work to be the couch? But no, this was the case. And I ended up having to, I mean, fortunately, here we get back to heirloom discourse. My grandmother had passed away and my parents were keeping one of her, or rather two of her mid-century couches in a storage unit, hoping that maybe eventually somebody would be able to take them. And one of these couches was exactly the right length to go in the one place in my home where you could put a couch. So I took one, and then my little brother took the other. And so the couches were dispersed to, you know, to good homes.
Yeah. And also that's lucky in terms of siblings, right? So you're not going to be fighting over who got the couch.
Right. But in the meantime, like, I still have now like these other two couches that we moved with that are just in the basement. I mean, they just live there and I don't know what to do with them because like one of them was also an heirloom and it's like, I don't know. I feel bad about getting rid of it. I also feel bad that it's in the basement. That was a really long, dumb story.
No. I find this interesting. So we moved a ton at various points, and including internationally, which sounds so cosmopolitan, but it's just like over the border into Canada and back.
It does, though. It does sound cosmopolitan.
Very cosmopolitan. But we had at one point some furniture just like from my parents' apartment that was different from IKEA, right? It was like not this sort of generic stuff. I mean, it wasn't, I don't know if heirloom would quite be it, but it was, you know, a little bit varied, or just like stuff that we had gotten just for free at various points. Like some neighbors were once getting rid of a couch and we got things like that, right? But then we moved at one point to a furnished apartment because it was my husband's postdoc housing and it just had furniture in it. So we had to get rid of, like, we had this really nice couch that we'd gotten for free just from neighbors once, in New York, and we don't have it anymore. And like all we had, I don't want to say better furniture, as in like it was not Versailles, but like we had furniture and then like didn't have furniture and then had to sort of very quickly get a lot of furniture when we were in the place we lived before this house. So yeah, our furniture is such absolute garbage, except for one thing. And can I talk about that just briefly and then we'll talk about other stuff?
Is it the credenza?
It's the credenza. Can I talk about the credenza for a second?
Talk about the credenza.
Okay. So we were having a sort of like crisis of the, like, this house does not have an entryway closet, entryway storage, anything. You come in, you need to like figure out somewhere to put your coat, boots, whatever. Like, there are hooks for coats. It's just everything else is just a crapshoot and it's a big pile and it doesn't really work. And what we were doing, which is extremely chic, is putting our like keys, things like mail, onto a bookcase that's pretty far into the house that was being used for storage. And that was like, you know, when you see like in a staged house or something, or a nice house, there's like a little table in the entryway when you first walk in, maybe a mirror even, you know, where people put things down.
Yes.
We have like, we don't have that. We don't have anywhere to put that. We have a stroller where that would potentially even go. But even if there weren't a stroller there wouldn't be the width for it. We thought about all different things. You had a really good IKEA suggestion of some sort of thing that folds out from the wall, but like the width of this space would not even handle that. Like, it's really, really narrow. And there's a vent in the entryway.
Oh.
So there's just so much. So like where you don't want to like put your keys or rings or whatever somewhere and like it all goes down a vent. But anyway, this credenza. Yes, I searched for a credenza and ordered a used piece of enormous furniture from the internet, but it worked. It's in the house. It looks good. We haven't actually filled it with stuff yet. So there's still a lot of the mess, but I'm very excited.
And it's a beautiful like mid-century piece, right?
It is. I did a reverse image search and it seems like it's probably something from Quebec called Victoriaville. Ooh. From around the 1960s. That would be my guess. It is not a valuable piece of furniture, it does not seem. However, there was a different... So we paid about like $600 Canadian for it, something like that. And there's some other
place... What is that in real money?
That $3. But but I think some other store was charging twice that for a similar one, some other used furniture store. So I feel like I'm definitely an extremely sophisticated furniture shopper and not somebody who just bought the first thing they saw off the internet. But I'm excited about it.
Yeah, you should be. I mean, I think that there's like, I don't know, nothing has made me feel more like an established adult than like buying furniture that I know I intend to keep for the rest of my life. I don't know. There's just something kind of exciting about that.
I think I'm going to be so old by the time I get there. Like it's just, oh, yeah, one day.
Yeah, no, but you can take your time. There's no rush. You guys are in your house now. But I mean, I understand, like it's interesting when you have to kind of weigh this against, you know, your existing furniture that may or may not fit in your house. And then there's the furniture your parents have been hanging on to for you for, you know, who knows how long. There are things that my mom has been hanging on to, waiting for the eventuality of me finally having a house of my own. And then in many cases, it turned out that these things, as beautiful as they were and as much as I would have loved to take them, they don't fit in the house. Like there is simply no place for them. And so I had to be like, I'm sorry, you know, I know that you hung on to this thing. In some cases it was furniture that my grandfather made, so there was, you know, real sentimental attachment to it. And I'd be like, you know, and it's beautiful, but nevertheless, like I live where I live. And this is one of these things where it's very difficult when you have something that has sentimental value and that thing also happens to be like, I don't know, 72 by 65 inches wide and long and weighs several hundred pounds. Like all of this is to say, this is a very good argument for forming very kind of like cautious sentimental attachments to pieces of furniture in your parents' home or items in your parents' home that are not so big that they're going to cause a problem when you want to take them into your home.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I'm very curious though. On the China question, do you have wedding china? Like, did you register for China when you got married?
No. But what we did have at one point was china from my grandmother that we had to just give to a thrift store or something during one of these moves. And I wish we still had it. It was nice. I liked it. It was not possible. We just had like, there was nowhere it could go, basically. Mm-hmm. So did you get wedding china?
No, I very consciously decided I didn't want to bother registering for it because like I didn't like anything that was on offer, but I do really like my mom's china, which is, I think it's not from when she got married, it's antique. So it belonged to somebody else before her. And one of the nice things when I moved into my house, because I did know like in advance that I wanted some of this stuff and she has like so much of it, she just gave me half her china collection. So now I have my own china. It's something called India tree. It's from like the 1900s.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. I found something like they were getting rid of china at some tea shop that was closing. And I brought it home and I was really excited about it. And I was like, we're going to have tea parties. And then I was looking up online that like that type of china has like lead in it and you can't actually drink from it. And I was very, very sad. Oh. So now I'm using it for like decoration, but I don't know. Who knows? But yeah, but I'm going to buy these people's mahogany dining sets off. The thing is like, that's the other thing. It's like, there is some market for this sort of thing. It's just, you would have to be somebody interested in like getting rid of it. Like, that's the thing I find fascinating on like marketplace, like Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist or whatever, things like this, where you have this mix of people who are like trying to sell some special item. and people who just like get this enormous thing out of my house now, you know, you get kind of a mix, and you get people who definitely you have to gauge whether they secretly mean the second thing.
Right. Right. That's when you can negotiate.
Yeah. But what if you're left with a Nazi helmet?
I mean, for me, it's not what if you have a Nazi helmet. It's what if you don't have the space for all of the Nazi helmets that you have amassed over the course of, of a lifetime of collecting Nazi helmets, you know, or your parents' Nazi helmet collection for that matter. But this was a New York Times ethicist column. Yeah, you think the mahogany dining set that you can't fit in your dining room is bad. What of the Nazi helmet that you've inherited and are now troubled by having in your home? This was the question, right? Should I read this aloud? It's a short, I'm just going to read this aloud. I really enjoyed this. I own a Nazi helmet my husband, now deceased, inherited from his father. For a long time, it didn't bother me. It only left me wondering about the soldier who wore it. But with the resurgence in white supremacy, neo-fascism, and anti-Semitism, I am now very uncomfortable with it. I can't seem to figure out what to do with it. I don't think a museum would be interested in it. I certainly would never sell it, being uneasy about who might buy it. So I don't know. Something about this was very funny, especially the idea that like, oh, this didn't bother me until I noticed the resurgence in white supremacy, neo-fascism, and anti-Semitism.
Oh, so many thoughts about this. I have like a million thoughts about this. So first, when I read this letter, I thought of all sorts of like practical things, like you can turn it into a vase, you can do that, you know, like somehow I was just thinking about like, whoa, you have this object in your house, what are you gonna do with it? But it's also like, so one thing that came up in responses to that article or to something I tweeted about, I don't remember, was somebody was pointing out that like allied soldiers sometimes, this was like a trophy, and it's not pro-Nazi that you would own this, and rather the contrary.
Yes, indeed. It's like, you know, if you were really lucky, the helmet would still be attached to the severed head of the Nazi that you killed. But those are just hard to get through customs.
I would imagine so. But yeah, so that's one thing that it doesn't necessarily, you could be Antifa because you have this in your house. The other part is like, I couldn't really gauge what this person's politics are. And I think that's because it's a normie who wrote in. Because is this somebody, like, where does this person stand, like, left, right, on, like, Israel stuff? Like, I have no idea. This is just something like, people should be nice to one another. And I just realized that Nazis are bad and I'm sad. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like somebody who's extremely, extremely unplugged from discourse, who's wondering about this, to the point that they don't even have kind of a team, as it were, on anything. And they're just like, yeah, I don't know, which was kind of refreshing, I guess. What would you do if you had a Nazi helmet that you had to do something with?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, make a lovely decoupage on it, use it as a planter, serve matzo ball soup in it.
I think that's the best thing.
We fucking win. But this is reminding me of, on the subject of weird things that you can inherit, a close friend of mine is currently, her mother has moved to assisted living. And so she's going through her mother's apartment, just like a lifetime of belongings that have been amassed there. And I guess hired somebody to start doing this, since, you know, she lives in a different state, gets a phone call from the estate person who's busy, like, you know, doing the top to bottom cleaning and categorizing of all of her mother's belongings, to inform her that she has just found a jar that contains a human brain.
Well, I mean, just, yeah, I assume you have some of those as well. Do they have a reason for why? Like, was it for a lab? Was it?
Yeah, apparently there's a whole story behind it. And apparently the discovery of the brain was not a surprise to my friend or to her brother. They were like, oh, you found the brain. So what really is funny is that they didn't warn the estate person that there would be a brain, which seems like the kind of thing.
But why was the brain there? Do you know?
It was not an exciting story. Ultimately, people used to donate their brains to science, and then like there would be a brain in a jar, and then sometimes like the lab would close and they would need to do something
right
with,
like,
the brain.
Like, there's that museum in Philadelphia,
the Mutter Museum.
Yes,
I've been like there that, oh, it's an amazing place.
As have I. It is. Yeah, so I guess you just need to make sure you have a matching helmet that fits that brain,
right?
And then your entryway is complete. That's what this credenza is missing, to be honest.
You know, it's a shame that your entryway and mine, I think, also are too narrow to accommodate an entire brain in a jar.
You have to have in those little thin slices, right?
Right, right. A little, like, a little subsection of brain or another body part entirely. I might have room for, like, a disembodied penis if it were small enough. Rasputin's penis, no, but just, you know, anyway.
Well, that would be very sexually adventurous of you. So are we going to do divorce rings? Apparently there are divorce rings. And I think this was another popular request where somebody was pointing us to this article. It's one of these like New York Times styles articles that we have to do.
What's a divorce ring? Explain this to me.
So it's like when Carrie Bradshaw registers for her being single or something and wants shoes, that instead of having an engagement ring, you turn your engagement ring into a I'm better off without him ring. And you do so for the low, low price of several thousand real dollars, because it's this coming from America. So not Canadian dollars, but like the real ones from America. And you can get it kind of made to look like a different style of ring, basically. So you can use the materials and do something else with it. This is important because Emrata, Emily Ratajkowski, is she got one of these. So it matters. And I think we're talking about this both because of the heirloom theme, but also in part because of one particular ring. Do you want to explain about that ring?
What's very funny to me also is that if you look at this piece, this report on the New York Times website, at least for me, in between there are like lots of pictures of these rings that have been refashioned into divorce rings, but also all the ads on the page were for Harry Winston rings, and I was very confused at first.
I have Van Cleef and Arpels. Okay, yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
So okay, yeah. There are many descriptions of like the kinds of rings that are being created. You know, you take your engagement ring or your wedding ring or both. I guess some people have like a lot of stones. Stones as in diamonds, not stones as in like, you know, balls. They refashion something more befitting a woman who's single and loving it. And this was, I think we agreed, the winning description, the winning ring. This is from the article. It says, Madison Snyder, 31, the founder and chief executive of Fewer Finer, a jewelry brand, restyled a client's classic solitaire diamond ring into an evil eye-shaped signet ring with the diamond in its center to mark the client's divorce. Inside the ring, Ms. Snyder engraved the word badass, which she said is how the client felt after the transformation.
I can't, could you imagine you go on a date with this woman who's divorced and she's like, And you say, oh, that's a nice ring. And she takes it off and shows you.
Look, it says in the middle, badass inside.
Badass.
I cringed so hard that my soul left my body when I read that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think it is also a reminder of the normie world that continues and a sort of earnest style in feminism that seems very out of date, maybe, to those of us here sitting in the avant-garde as we are in our
maybe
houses.
I'm too cynical. Maybe this is really actually just like, you know, the live, laugh, love decor of divorce rings, that you have your ring that says badass on the inside. But there is something, like, just to go completely galaxy-brained, like this idea that like you're taking an experience that is kind of fundamentally negative and you say that this experience makes you a badass. I don't know. It's like the kind of masculinized. I don't know. Does this make sense? I may be overthinking this.
Well, I don't know. I think I might have a more a rosier take on this, which is that it's saying, and this is going to get to actually to segue it back to the thing that connects to the heirloom discourse part. Okay. I think it's kind of a way of saying that that was a part of your life and that you're not going to just say, nope, that never happened. Changing my name back if I changed it, whatever, you know.
Changing my name to badass.
Definitely. It's just this idea that like that was a part of somebody's life that did happen and they're not going to like will it out of existence and pretend like it's some void and that as if their life with that partner or with that spouse, never, like, as if those years didn't count. You know, it's like incorporate, it's like, this made me who I am sort of thing, which gets to this other heirloom discourse aspect, which we were discussing before recording, of like, is there an expectation when a couple divorces that the woman gives a ring back? And yeah, I don't know what that is. There, you were saying you think there's an etiquette on this?
I thought there was, you know, I should have looked this up before we started talking. But just to be clear, when I was saying that, like, you know, the idea of like lionizing your failure, I wasn't specifically talking about the divorce ring thing, which is kind of whatever to me. I, you know, it's like if you have a piece of jewelry that no longer suits you, I don't see anything wrong with having it remade. It was specifically the thing about how, like, I feel so badass after my divorce. Like, that was the...
I see.
That very specifically. But is there an etiquette about, so I do think, like, if you are engaged and you break the engagement, that you have to give the ring back. And I have known women who broke their engagements and did not give the ring back. And I thought that was very, very tacky. But if you're married, yeah, it's an interesting question. Do you give the ring back? And I think where I landed is, no, you probably don't, unless the ring was like a family heirloom from your husband. And then maybe you do give it back because there might be somebody else, not for him, but like connected to the family who would want to have it. Like maybe there's a, like a niece or a daughter, you know, somebody related by blood who deserves to have, like, if you're trying to keep the ring in the family and you're no longer part of the family. And this is like, I have not thought this through. This is just an idea. This is the circumstances under which I think it would be conceivably like the proper thing and good manners to return your engagement ring after you've been married and divorced.
So I think I may, I don't know whether it's a disagreement or just it would depend on the circumstances thing. I think if a couple gets married, the next day the wife is like, never mind, that you're still in kind of that engagement ring zone where, like, yeah, that would be time to maybe like do that. But I think if you're talking about like a people who've been married for like 30 years or something, I think heirloom or not, it's the ring of the person who's been wearing it for decades. And it would be very weird to like even to accept it back, if that makes sense. Like it would just be like that person, it is her family item. She has been wearing it for 30 years every day, right? Mm-hmm. So, and also if there are kids, she's going to pass it along to those kids.
Right. Yeah, that I think changes things. I don't know. I had constructed this very specific idea in my mind of like when you would, but I was not accounting for the notion of there being children. So yeah, I don't know. I think I may have backed myself into a weird corner here, and I would just like to forfeit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're just going to be after this podcast getting our rings engraved with badass, but we have to do, can we do, we've done old stuff, but can we talk about the old men, please? Because I really, I know we've
old
been,
men.
I yes. know we've been talking for a while, but like we really do have to talk about the old man a little
yes.
bit.
Yes. We've wasted a lot of time shooting the shit, but really the meat of this entire conversation is at this point, it's like slightly old news, and yet we're still going to talk about it. This essay in The Cut, which is doing like a booming business of going viral. Somebody, I guess maybe it was J. Caspian Kang, observed that like The Cut is the only publication that still goes viral on Twitter ever. And I was talking with Ethan Strauss on his podcast last week. He was saying, why is it that The Cut is getting all of these incredibly viral essays? And I said that I thought it had a lot to do with the incredible power of having like a protagonist in an essay who people love to hate, and, you know, having like an unlikable woman in some way involved is, I mean, that's kind of like The Cut's bread and butter. And that is like the one thing that's powerful enough to overcome even Elon's algorithm suppression on Twitter, that you can, you know, you can still get a mob going against the writers of these essays. So this essay was by Grazie. Is her name actually thank you?
I mean, if
you?
It's an Italian, thank you.
Let's say Grazie.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Grazie Sophie uh-huh. Christie. It's like the duck, duck, goose of women's names. She wrote about age gap relationships and why they're good. Specifically, it's because if you marry an older man as a younger woman, you will be taken care of in some way, like financially and otherwise, which in her case, yes, but I don't think this really has as much to do with the age gap as it does to do with the milieu in which she was selecting a future husband, which is to say Harvard Business School.
But all men, Kat, all men over the age of 30 have degrees from Harvard Business School. Did you not know that?
Right. You reach a certain age and, you know, along comes some deity to take your hair and give you a Harvard Business degree. That's just how it goes.
Yes. So this was, there's a line from it that I'm going to have to read because it's really funny, where she talks about how she would go each Saturday to the Harvard Business School to work on my Nabokov paper. Nabokov. I know the name. I just can't speak. Anyway, okay. In one cavernous, well-appointed room sat approximately 50 of the planet's most suitable bachelors. I had high breasts, most of my eggs, plausible deniability when it came to purity, a flush ponytail, a pep in my step that had yet to run out, apologies to progress, this is with a capital P, progress, but older men still desired those things. End quote. So there's a lot here.
The flush ponytail has captured my imagination.
The flush ponytail is really, really a funny idea. And I'm in like DMs with people specifically about that. The flood is a flush ponytail. And what is it? So Kat, what is a flush ponytail?
Is it like flush with hair? Or is it like lush? Did she mean lush? A lush ponytail? But can you have a flush ponytail in the same way that you're flush with cash?
Well, I can't figure it out. I think what she means, okay, is that as people get older, like much older, they're especially men type people, their hair thins. I'm picturing like the old guy who's like bald but for a ponytail, and she's not that. You know what I mean?
That's such a look.
Yeah. Like that she's, why go to the trouble to say that's not what you look like when you're, how many women do? It's not extremely common, but I mean, it happens and it's unfortunate what it does, but it's not, you know, it's not like you turn 21 and your 20-year-old flush ponytail becomes, anyway. So there is this thing that happens every, I don't know if it's every few years, every couple minutes, whatever, where somebody has this, I'm not gonna be all PC about it. Men like 18-year-olds, men like 20-year-olds. It's like, and somebody will say it as if this is like earth-shattering and they're going to be canceled for it, but they're going to say this brave truth. When like everybody has seen these studies about like dating apps and that men click on the 18-year-olds, everybody knows that attractive, very young women turn men's heads. I don't think this is like, I don't think there is this. It's a little bit like the our boobs back thing. Like, I think some of these things are just, you're like, there will always be somebody who's really, really, you know, PC or whatever, saying actually a plain looking 50-year-old woman is considered more attractive than an attractive 18-year-old.
In some cultures.
Exactly. So I don't even know who she's arguing against. I thought this was very funny. But also when you look at what she's actually talking about, she's talking about being an undergrad, hanging around grad students, and all of these people are young. And the women that she's thinking that she's got this edge over are like 25-year-old grad student women. They're not like old women, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're, in terms of this question of the high breasts, I'm like wondering, what does she imagine happens to the breasts of somebody who's like in, you know, like a few years older than you? Like, I don't know. It just, she seems to have a lot of notions of aging and like how popular a 20-year-old versus a 25-year-old would be at a party, when I feel like there are other variables that would be greater. And also the husband, the old man, is not actually old, is the other little funny part of this.
I have a couple questions. So she's 20, he's 30 when they meet, right?
When they meet, yes.
Yeah. I'm confused. I'm not sure how old she is now.
27, apparently. She's 27.
So she, it's cute. Like, I mean, she has absolutely no concept as of yet of what it actually is like to be over 30. And that's fine. I would maybe be like slightly more careful about how authoritatively I made declarations about it under the circumstances, but you know, to each her own. I guess the thing, so if this is business school, I will say the grad students in question probably were a little bit older. Often you get people who are like, they'll have jobs in some like corporate or finance capacity, and then their company will pay for them to go to business school. So you end up with people who are maybe closer to 30 anyway.
Whose ponytails have gone the way of the
right,
man.
Right, whose ponytails are just like, look. Just one hair. There's just one hair in the ponytail. But it's very
like a
long.
Dr. Seuss kind of look. Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is so, like, there's something very kind of wish casting about this. And I just hope for her sake that the author, when she reaches the advanced age of like 32, isn't horrified to discover that actually her boobs are basically in the same place that they were when she was 22 and her ponytail is still nice and flush or whatever the fuck. And that she, you know, she didn't actually need to get married in a big hurry. She could have probably waited if she wanted to. I mean, it also sounds like she was in love with this man, which is, you know, which is good. Like, I think, you know, marry the person that you've fallen in love with, but
don't make a think piece about why that's the only appropriate thing to do. Like, so my husband is older by 6 days than I am.
Ugh, disgusting.
I can't imagine writing a think piece about why that is the appropriate way to do things. Because it's like, obviously, you do, like, you meet a person and, you know, it works with that person. And there isn't some sort of, like, the idea that you could be, that your marriage could be sort of funneled into a think piece like this, it also reads then as very protest too much, right? Like, I did the right thing, unlike these other people who did the wrong thing. I did the right thing, see. And it seems like she's not quite convinced. Like, it almost reads like she's trying to convince herself that she did the right thing, which is never very reassuring. But also, yeah, there is something where she both seems to, like, at the same time, over and underestimate the importance of youth. Like, she... I don't know if I'm getting this quite right, but like, yeah, obviously you don't change fully in appearance in some dramatic way between like 20 and 22 or whatever it is she's so worried about. But I don't know, but she also seems very like blasé. So she's 27 and she's like, maybe we'll like have kids at some point. She's like in no hurry. And I don't know, that I found a little strange. Given the way she's so focused on her eggs and whatnot and the basket in which they sit. But there was a line about that, though, that I found very concerning. Where was this? Yes, where she writes, "When I have a child, I will expect more help from him," that's her husband, "than I would if he were younger. For what does professional tenure earn you if not the right to set more limits on work demands, or if not, to secure some childcare at the very least?" So that's, it ends at a question mark. So that part of it struck me as interesting in what it says about just how she conceives of her marriage generally. Also, this idea that things that they need as a household are his gifts to her, and that seems to be their dynamic. And she has a part that a lot of people who were criticizing the article and the author's choices, not that these are the same thing, but whatever, although we will actually just maybe briefly mention about that. But we're saying that she talks about how he pays their rent and how she feels she can't argue with him because she's financially dependent on him, but also how wonderful it is because she doesn't have to have a day job as a writer or whatever. But then it just seemed like there was something very weird and bleak to me about projecting into the future that they would be this couple with a kid and they would need childcare, and that's something he's going to provide for her. It just seemed very, very like the worst of all worlds somehow. I don't know. It seemed like not trad wife, but also not sort of feminist 50-50. I don't know. To me, that part just did jump out at me.
There is something interesting about the way that she kind of conceives of this part of her life as though it's almost as though she sees it as having either sidestepped the sort of growing pains of being in your early 20s and getting yourself established, or like she pressed pause and was able to enjoy this sort of extended adolescence where, you know, the role of a father or a parental kind of caretaker was taken over by this man that she married. She talked about how like how great it was that she was able to not just do some writing, and that she can write for free, and like, and how isn't that so wonderful because she has the financial support of her husband, but also that, like, you know, she learned to cook a little bit and to decorate a little bit. Like, there's something kind of funny about the idea. It's like, I got married so that I could develop hobbies or something along those lines.
Yeah. It's just, it's very hard to pinpoint. And I mean, I think in terms of, first of all, just that whole question of whether people are mad at the writer or the essay, I think that gets very blurred when somebody is presenting their essay as an argument to live as they do, which is what this is, and which is extremely what Emily Gould's was not. Emily Gould was not saying, live like me, I am your role model. It was not the case for living like Emily Gould, you know? Whereas I think when somebody is doing that, it is kind of fair game to judge in a different way. And like, that's kind of the only reading that makes sense. I am interested in why The Cut ran this apart from the sort of clickbait aspect, because it seemed very, I've never listened to the Red Scare podcast, I'm going to confess. And I don't really know what's happening with the Dimes Square scene, but I think it might be that this comes out of, where it's this kind of trad but not kind of world. Oh. Where it's like she's very critical of the girl bosses and she's critical of that, but she's still a sort of downtown scenester type, you know, like she's not actually going and like milking the goat or whatever. So that was one thing that it seemed very strange at, like, just how anti-feminist this essay is on The Cut, which so recently ran something about what if your sons grow up to be on the right, and
right,
what a disaster that would be.
So I'm very interested in how this essay situates itself, like, on a landscape where, yeah, trad wives also exist, or rather trad wife influencers, who are not really the same thing as actual trad wives. And the thing that strikes me is that there's a lot of kind of LARPing as something. There's a lot of sense of like, I'm living this aspirational lifestyle, but there's not actually a life to go with it. Many of these women who are trad wives, you know, self-described, who make this content, who talk about how, like, you know, it's the woman's job to, like, be domestic, be in the domestic sphere, raise children. A lot of them don't have kids. They may intend to have them, but they don't.
It makes it a lot easier.
Yeah,
it makes it a lot easier to perform parenthood if there aren't actual children.
And not only that, but it's like they don't actually, it's like they're talking about the kind of ideal or the idea of homesteading, but they don't have a homestead. They have like maybe a container garden on a balcony.
And cleavage.
And cleavage, yes. And, you know, these are nice things to have, but they do not, like, a traditional lifestyle make. It's just, I think that there's something analogous happening here. I mean, on one hand, she's talking about literally her life, the life she's living. And then on the other hand, she's talking about the kind of life this could be, or what it looks like to other people, or how you would brand it if you were making content about it. And it's like these things, you know, sometimes resemble each other, but they're not really the same thing.
Apparently she stripped her Instagram of any reference to him or anything after this article. I saw this online. I think I had kind of noticed that because I had looked her up when she had written this other essay about like how much easier it is for beautiful women and she's not one or something. This was on The Point. She's good at writing the clickbait essay. But yeah, so what struck me also was I was thinking about this whole idea of like a woman being at her peak appeal to men at this very young age. And you do see this a lot, but generally it's presented as, and that's why you should find a husband when you are that age. And the implication being the husband will be like maybe 2 years older than you, maybe 10, but it wouldn't be presented in this age gap kind of fetishized way. But that that this would be like a young man, right? Who you would mm-hmm. be getting together with. And I would say 30 counts, but I'm 40, so I would say that. But yeah, I'm just thinking that, like, what's interesting here is that she's so explicitly not just saying get married when you're young, but get married to somebody who isn't young. And it's this sort of case against young men. So she's like joining with the kind of men are garbage discourse a little bit, you know, like the young men don't even have a bed frame sort of.
Yes.
Like she's almost tapping into that. But then also there's this financial aspect that obviously keeps coming up. And what I found really, really fascinating, and I don't want to have like dropped this thread of it because it's just so weird, is people were mad at her online for being a trust fund baby. And they had looked her up, and her parents are, I don't know if they're doctors or lawyers or something. They have professional jobs, and they're, I guess, active in Catholic conservative circles in Miami or somewhere, or I don't know. The point is, I do not think that if you are rich and independently wealthy, you are doing the thing she's talking about. You are not going to Harvard Business School to pick somebody up. Now, if you are genuinely working class, you are probably not at Harvard to begin with and entering its business school to pick up men. But this idea that the salient thing about her is that she's so rich from her parents seems like, if that were the case, this would be a very different story.
Yes, indeed. I don't think she would have written this essay, because I don't think she would have had to do the thing that is the kind of foundational thesis of the essay, which is find somebody who can take care of you financially. If you have a trust fund,
you would be writing as a hobby for no pay, and that would be fine, and you wouldn't need a side job because you were independently wealthy.
Right. The whole point about this is that she's not independently wealthy. She is wealthy with strings attached.
Yes. And I just found it funny that it got the same sort of, people just have this privileged lens they have to throw on everything in the same exact sort of cookie cutter way. And I pointed this out and somebody replied, but look who her parents are. It's like, yes, I don't know how much money they are giving her. Probably not a whole lot if she's marrying some man who can pay her rent and then writing about how important it is that he pays the rent. Like, that doesn't strike me as something. And it just seemed like this thing where yes, obviously in the grand scheme of things, if she's at Harvard in the first place, she's an upscale person. But like, that just seemed like a very funny, it seemed like, I mean, it's going to be like a rude analogy, but it did seem a bit like, if you say that somebody is an upscale worker of a certain kind, as if you're saying that means they are upscale in a more general sense. And that is not what that means. It means something different.
Okay. To bring this full circle, here's the question.
Please do. Because yes.
Is it, if a woman, a young woman with a flush ponytail, sneaks into Harvard Business School parties as a Harvard undergrad with the explicit intention of bagging herself a rich fiance, is that sexually adventurous?
It's that is a tricky one. I mean, it's only going to be adventurous if he comes with the heirloom sideboard and it has the brain in it. But that's not sexual. So I don't know, because it depends what his plans are with the ponytail.
I was going to say, it depends on what his plans are with the brain. It could be sexual.
That's even better. You are going to, please tell me that you're going to have a novel. Is there going to be, you're going to be writing fiction about this brain, right? Like
100%. Yeah. This is going to, in fact, be my take on the 1980s classic Indecent Proposal, starring Demi Moore, Woody Harrelson, and Robert Redford. I think that's who was in that, right? Where he says, I'm going to give you $1 million if you let me sleep with your wife. But in my version, it's going to be, I'm going to give you my heirloom brain if you... if your wife lets me sleep with you, because why not?
Definitely.
All right.
This family friendly podcast. I don't know what else.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this conversation, you pervert, and would like to hear more like it, feel free to join us as a paid subscriber on Substack, where for $5 a month, you will get access to at least 2 premium episodes per month for subscribers only, as well as commenting privileges, open threads, and general frivolity. We are at femchaospod.substack.com, and we hope to see you there.
Free brain for the founding members.
Yes, free brains. you can have some extra of ours because we have too much, too many. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.